We interviewed 700 institutional investors around the world about their allocations to private markets and how they think about it. 70% of them think that sustainability, both on the energy, environmental impact, but also on the social side, is absolutely critical.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. If this is your first time joining us, I'm the host, Simon Brewer. And in this show, we talk to proven leaders and thinkers from the worlds of business, investing, and beyond.
Money talks and money moves. Which direction would you choose? It's the Money Maze, here to pave the way.
To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter via moneymazepodcast.com. Episodes are also published on our YouTube channel, and we're active on all major social media platforms. Thank you for listening. Today is the first time we welcome back a guest who has changed firms between interviews. In fact, we made a recording on Thanksgiving Day 2022, and our guest was then head of global research at Willis Towers Watson, an organization advising on over 2.6 trillion of assets. I re-listened to the interview this weekend, and you described being a child growing up behind the Iron Curtain in Vilnius, Lithuania, in the 1970s, and you said because of your father's job, you attended 10 schools in 10 years as your parents move around, and you added, the desire to continuously change things stayed with me as a grown-up. Well, prophetic indeed. You've been true to your word, and your journey began when you finished school and the Soviet Union collapsed. So, Lubor ochen peplot, privetsko Ivan Savonio, ochen rada videt vas snova.
Очень приятно быть здесь обратно. Спасибо, Саймон.
Fantastic. Well, I don't know what that means, but that's very nice of you to have said it. Welcome here.
Thank you so much, Simon. As you know, I'm a big fan of yours, and I really admire the work that you and Will Campion have done in the last, well, I hear 5-year anniversary soon.
Yeah,
so it is absolutely amazing. And there is a lot of content in our industry, but Money Maze manages to create this niche, which is really insightful and differentiated. So I do my best not to miss any episode. And it makes it a particular privilege to be here with you as one of your guests. So thank you for that.
That's a pleasure. And thank you very much for those kind words. You moved from Willis Towers Watson to IFM. New role as the Chief Strategy Officer. First, explain the motivation.
The motivation. One of the big mandates of my role as the first Chief Strategy Officer is to actually make IFM more well-known around the world. So when I was thinking about why am I joining, the task there was to transform an Australian manager with global ambitions into a global investment firm with a proud Australian heritage. I actually have a very long history with the firm. It was created 30 years ago by a group of Australian pension funds. We can go more into history. But my motivation there was that I actually met IFM in 2009 while still being part of Willis Towers Watson. And I was really, really impressed with the offering. So I was looking at exposure to infrastructure, and they had something genuinely innovative and aligned with clients' interest. I was a long-standing client, and when the opportunity came about to actually come over and help the firm to become more global, more diversified, more well-known, and even more aligned with clients' interest, I decided that this is an opportunity not to be missed.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about a number of those elements, but just for the sake of those listeners and viewers who haven't listened or watched the first episode, remind us of your career journey to this point. The abridged version.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So as you said, I grew up in the Soviet Union, and this is where I started my work just after the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was the privatization in Russia, Belarus, Ukraine. I was investing in private equity. I had my own business in the timber industry. And then I came to London to do an MBA at London Business School and really wanted to stay in private equity. It's actually quite interesting to think back to this time. Everyone wanted to be in private equity now, and everyone wants to be in infrastructure. There is a trend there in my career. Anyway, so I spent 17 years with Willis Towers Watson doing investment research, looking after, well, it was more than 2.6 trillion when I left. laughed. It was definitely more than $3 trillion of dollars under advice and management. So I started in private equity and then looked after all investment research. 17 years. I really liked that job. So IFM was probably the only firm that had a chance to attract me to change the job there.
Right. Well, that's terrific. Thank you. So IFM, you started to touch on it, but let's just unpack it a little bit because it is unusual because it was founded by the pension industry, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The story is fairly unique. So it was 30 years ago, and it was at the time where the superannuation industry in Australia was created, very much driven by labor unions, creating the system that has compulsory contributions and professional trustee governance. So this system was being created, while at the same time there was a large-scale privatization of airports, in particular in large cities of Australia. And so these professional trustees, as they were looking at new portfolios that were growing quite fast, and they were looking at these privatized assets, they couldn't find a good mechanism in the investment industry to invest in those assets and hold them forever as they wanted to and benefit from professional management and ongoing yield. So they got together, 27 pension funds, Australian supers, and created a collective vehicle, which is IFM, Industry Fund Management. This is profit-to-member model, i.e. all our profit they get back to savers, to pensioners. They created the first open-ended infrastructure fund, started investing firstly in Australian assets, then expanded internationally. Then when I met them, that was the expansion outside their regional shareholders into large pension funds around the world. So 30 years onwards, now we have more than 700 clients, in addition to the 17 owners. We didn't have any owners leave. It's just the consolidation of the Australian super industry, why we went from 27 to 17. We have 220 billion Australian dollars under management, which is, for those who are not on top of exchange rate, is around 150 billion US. And we also expanded in other asset classes. So we now have debt, private equity, listed equities as well. So yes, long and rich history, and to be continued, of course.
Great. Well, you've actually answered a couple of my questions already.
Sorry.
But that's perfect. Perfect, making my job easier. So half of that, give or take, is in infrastructure.
Exactly.
And I wanted to talk about infrastructure. It's been very instructive. We've done a number of interviews with what we call the super allocators. One of them was Mark Delaney of Australia Super, which is the biggest super fund in Australia. He described infrastructure as the ballast in the boat. And I think their allocation was over 7% of their fund. And just this week, we had Marcy Frost, the CEO of CalPERS, the largest, you know, public pension policy in the US, saying that they're very keen on infrastructure and, in fact, are planning on increasing it, especially in North America. In your own words, what is infrastructure's role in a multi-asset portfolio?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting metaphor about ballast. I was listening to this episode with Mark, and we were actually referring a couple of times to ballast. I was just wondering, like, not sure if it's good. Let's say I'm not going to argue with one of our largest shareholders, but rather enhance the analogy. Because ballast, it's sort of a nautical term which actually means stability and resilience. But sometimes it means that if you cannot move forward fast, then you drop it off. And this is not infrastructure. So it's sort of like not only ballast, but then probably, I don't know, buoyancy as well. And this is the unique feature of infrastructure, that it allows you to benefit from the resilience and stability. But then at the same time, there is also the potential for returns to propel your boat forward. So stability and moving forward as well. So essentially, in the asset allocation, it's something between bonds and equities where you can sort of, in bad times, protect your portfolio because you get real cash flows and assets that people have to use. There is no option not to use water utilities or electricity. But then at the same time, they also give you return.
Great. Well, we're going to talk about a few of those strands. We had an exchange early this week, and you've been talking at The Hague, and you said infrastructure is getting lots of attention, and your quotation was, feels like private equity 25 years ago. I'd like you to elaborate.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was in the midst of private equity 25 years ago, and it felt a little bit like everyone wanted to talk about private equity, be it asset allocators or investment banks or asset managers. I was graduating from London Business School. Private Equity Club was the largest club on the campus. Everyone wanted to get a job in private equity. So at the moment, infrastructure feels almost in the same tipping point where there is enough knowledge and there is enough, a critical mass of investors who have experience like us or our clients or our owners. 30 years of successful track record is something to consider. But then at the same time, there is also a big wave of newcomers because the market context, the environment just has this catalyst for the interest.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. The 3D reset of decarbonization, demographics, and deglobalization are reshaping the investment landscape. At Schroders and for their clients, understanding the 3Ds, how they affect the global economy, what that means for market volatility, and how active investors should be allocating their assets are the key to deciphering what comes next for investors and where the opportunities are. Find out more about the 3D reset and what it means for your investment strategy at Schroders.com. Remember, capital is at risk with investing. I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the World Gold Council. They champion the role gold plays as a strategic asset through expert research, commentary, and insights. And it's not just your portfolio that may benefit from gold. Learn how gold mining is supporting female economic empowerment and small businesses via their new documentary series called Gold, The Journey Continues. Tap the link in the show notes to start watching. So it's sitting there, I think, increasingly accepted as part of the private asset equation. Is that right in your opinion? And how are investors, institutional investors, first of all, thinking about it in relation to the past?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Private assets or private markets, you're now pushing me back into my whole job of being an investment consultant. Yes, absolutely. As an asset allocator, you have to think about private markets holistically, not the last, because those assets are more illiquid than the rest of your portfolio. So you need to ensure that you have a certain liquidity budget. And then the question is, how do you use it, this liquidity budget? So private equity, real estate, they are sort of mainstay of institutional investors in the US, here in Europe. Infrastructure to a degree is a newcomer. So Australia and Canada, they are somewhat of an outlier. So these markets have somewhere between 10 to 20% allocation just to infrastructure. Everywhere else in the world, we are talking about low single digits. And so infrastructure is now on the rise there as an allocation that is getting an increasing attention. I should also mention private credit, private debt. So it's particularly after the GFC and bank deleveraging. There has been a lot of interest in this area, and more recently in the last couple of years as the rates changed rather rapidly. So private credit and private debt also got quite a bit of attention. But at the moment, if you look at other asset classes, let's just quickly go through them. Private equity, they have people who, asset allocators who allocate to private equity, they tend to be at the moment full because firstly the denominator effect and now there is the lack of sales, right? So investors are sitting and waiting for realizations. Real estate, a separate story, but there is a lot of going on in real estate, valuations, circular changes, what's happening with offices. So there is a lot of drama going in the real estate sector. Private debt, we can see a certain signs of initial fractures in this area, especially as there is so much capital that was invested in the last couple of years and the lending standards with new entrants started softening. So where do you go if you have a bit of a liquidity budget and you want both the resilience, the ballast, and the growth, the buoyancy? You go into infrastructure.
Got it. And one of the things that Warren Buffett will always remind us is he loves moats. And of course, what little I know or have learned is that you don't put two toll roads or bridges next to each other typically. So explain a little bit about the barriers to entry and the sort of the, I'm not going to use the word uniqueness because I don't like that, but the special characteristics of the projects.
Sure, absolutely. Projects, assets, these. So as an investor, what you want to get is cash flows that are resilient. So no matter what happens with the world, even if it is closed down because of the pandemic or anything else that happens, you want to get these cash flows. As a result, you look into assets that fulfill the societal need that is essential. So when we think about the definition of infrastructure, it sort of started with water utilities, power supply and transmission, transport, toll roads, airports, ports. And then more recently, it started pushing into the digital infrastructure, telecom towers, data centers. But all of these assets, you wouldn't, as you say, build bridges next to each other. So if you have a bridge, then it is very likely that this bridge will have the monopolistic characteristic. It's very expensive to build. It's also, well, unless you use a boat, you need a bridge, right, to cross the river. So it was quite interesting during the pandemic to see how even ports, toll roads, they haven't fully lost the cash flows because people stopped traveling, but cargo, goods, they still had to be moved around. Similarly, water utilities, electricity supply, all of this continued to generate cash flows for our investors. Although, obviously, this was a fairly hard time for everyone.
So you know, as having been a pension fund consultant, that investors love to sit there and think about resilience, volatility, and returns. And when you sit there across the table with people who haven't necessarily invested in that space, how do you position that? Volatility is probably less difficult, but how do you manage return or think about return expectations?
Yeah, in infrastructure in particular. So I would probably put it into two buckets. The first bucket is mature infrastructure, those bridges, airports, toll roads that already exist. So to be able to generate additional return, A, you need to have a very strong asset management function. So people who work with management teams find new ways to create value. Capital expenditures is a significant part of the investment thesis. And it's really interesting in this bucket because if you think about, I don't know, Stansted Airport, we've just approved the capital expenditure more than $1 billion. The reality is it's almost like a proprietary deal flow. It's not being shopped around. It's Stansted Airport that is building this for the benefit of the expansion of the overall value proposition of this asset. So all of this creates the additional return potential and ultimately returns. Now, the second bucket is really interesting. And I think this bucket of new developments in infrastructure, building new assets, is actually another big reason why there is so much interest in the asset class right now, because we really need to transition our power system into the net zero carbon light future. And it requires a lot of renewable energy, but also complete rewiring of the way the infrastructure is being run. There is also all this AI phenomenon that I know that a lot of your guests discuss. And this requires a lot of new infrastructure that is being built. So the tailwind that society needs to build all of this additional infrastructure is quite enormous. And when you build, the return potential is, of course, much more significant. So this bucket, it probably loses a bit of its resilience, because resilience sits with the mature assets that have this monopolistic characteristic. But the return potential in this type of infrastructure that requires the skill of building something new is quite enormous.
So I'm just digesting that. So we have old and we have new. And you just talked about energy, and we've just interviewed Scott Guthrie, who runs AI and cloud for Microsoft. And as you know, they've just essentially underwritten Three Mile Island with a whole nuclear program because of their energy demands. Have you suddenly got a new batch of competitors who have turned up, which are the platform companies that have big balance sheets and a big energy demand?
Yeah, no, it's a competition, absolutely competition in the space, because the world needs so much of it. Actually, quite coincidentally, the week before last, we had a client conference in Nevada where we had an asset tour of one of the companies that we own. It's called Switch. It's the largest data center provider in the US. And Las Vegas is where they started in 2000. And at the moment, the campus is just absolutely amazing there. And all of Amazon, Google, Microsoft of this world, they are customers. So yes, they are building their own supply there, but then also these data centers that now are located around the US and provide these services. And Simon, you should have seen it. Maybe next time we invite you to our client conference, because it was like being in a sci-fi movie. It's a beautiful asset to own, but there is also a great management team who are excited about the future and building this asset. And the potential there is just absolutely fantastic.
So let's just stop on that decarbonization. I get how it can be implemented with new buildings, but you've got old buildings with, and I'm not sure how you measure the digital footprint of those, or the carbon footprint, I should say. How do we think about what's happening and what's in the ground as opposed to what's going to go in the ground?
Yeah, no, absolutely. By the way, you reminded me that this asset, which is data centers, they are some of the largest energy consumers, and it is 100% green. So this is what happens with those assets that are being built new by competent, intelligent management teams. They start thinking to the future, right? So you need to have A, energy security, the supply there, but also preferably the decarbonized energy supply. So just thinking about the decarbonization, and maybe here it's a good way to introduce the research that we did recently with the Financial Times. It's called the Private Markets Barometer 700. So we interviewed 700 institutional investors around the world about their allocations to private markets and how they think about it. And an interesting takeaway there that all of them think, well, not all of them, let's like 70% of them think that sustainability, both on the energy environmental impact, but also on the social side, is absolutely critical in these private markets transactions. And so when we think about the decarbonization or energy transition assets, it almost doesn't matter where you are based, in the US, in the UK, in Europe, you are thinking about the commercial sustainability of your asset. And this is an asset that you're not planning to sell in the next year or two or five. You want to own it forever. And as a result, the energy supply has to be green.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm excited to announce that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, known as LSEG. At the heart of the global economy, LSEG provides data, analytics, and infrastructure that connects investors, businesses, and economies. LSEG is where ideas meet capital, enabling sustainable growth and opportunity. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more. Now, you have just touched at the geographic dimension that I wanted to understand better, because you know Marcy Frost from CalPERS talks about the need to do it. They want to increase it. She talked about the specific US requirement. And many of us who traveled around the US kind of are aghast that this extraordinarily profitable nation, you know, has such lousy infrastructure in so many places. Now we have a new president who might be less enthusiastic about that, but these are very long-term plans. In terms of the hierarchy, or is there not a hierarchy? Is it English-speaking countries where the access as well as the options is greatest? Or, you know, how do you cut it? How do you cut up the priorities?
In infrastructure allocations, yes.
Yes.
So the way we think about it is governance and the rule of law. So when you talk about stable, resilient cash flows, it is really important that you are comfortable with the governance system. And yes, the situation in the US is interesting, but nevertheless, this country, if we think about the last 4 years, have probably done more than any other country in the world in terms of building the renewable energy supply and other energy transition opportunities because of the Inflation Reduction Act there. If we looked at the pipeline, then this is where a significant number of new opportunities were coming through tax incentives. And look, it remains to be seen how the new administration is going to approach it. But for now, the rule of law is there, and we know that those tax incentives that were already embedded in those assets, they are there. And by the way, interesting factoid there that actually those assets, the amount of money invested in the Republican states is 10 times higher in those assets than in the Democratic state. So to start shifting somehow, it's just like, well, the important thing is, do people actually benefit from that? Do we create jobs as we create those assets? There is one asset which is called Swift Energy, where there is a partnership with the city of Chicago, and it's the second largest solar wind asset in the US. And by building this solar farm through the local components, we managed to create 400 jobs. It will be completed by the end of this year. And one of the reasons we were able to do it is because of the Inflation Reduction Act incentives. Now, we invest in OECD countries, so the US is a big market for us, but we also own assets here in the UK, where I live, although I spend a lot of time traveling around the world. So here we're also looking for opportunities to invest more in the economy to help it transition while at the same time earning returns for our investors. So just recently, with the new Labour government in place, we signed the Memorandum of Understanding with the government here, where we are planning to invest $10 billion into the economy. It is supported both by our Australian owners and clients, but also by some of the existing and prospective clients here in the UK, and also developed together the so-called Energy Transition Blueprint in partnership with the government. So all of this work, just thinking about it, when you invest in infrastructure, you really need to be intelligent about how you work with the government and have resources on your team. So I have more than 20 people who do just that. They engage with governments here in the UK, in Europe, in the US, and in Australia to ensure we can help find great opportunities.
Well, before we leave the US, we had one of our most successful interviews with Scott Bessent, George Soros' former CIO, who may well have a role in the Trump administration, maybe Treasury Secretary or something like that. He will definitely get that, you know, what you're doing as a markets person. But I'm also, whilst I completely understand the demand that is growing and how the projects are executed, the sourcing of those, okay, so you have a team that's talking to governments, but how would you say these opportunities typically, Stansted Apple might be one, how do they come along? How are they discovered?
Yeah, no, this is where you genuinely need to have the name in the market, but also a very experienced team and an infrastructure scale. So that's quite important. 30 years of history of investing is really important. When an existing asset is for sale, there is a limited number of people that you would approach as a potential seller. Also, creating new opportunities is quite important when you work with certain assets. Like there is one asset in the US, it's called Green Gas, where essentially we are taking the agricultural waste and transform it into methane. And then we use the existing transmission lines that were used for fossil fuel transmission, now is pumping methane and green fuel. Now, the reason that this deal has come together is because we work, like, it's been decades of working together, knowing your partnership, your partners, your people with whom you are going to say, okay, we know that the transmission lines are here, and we almost like, it's like a little ecosystem there. No, actually, not a little, it's a pretty significant ecosystem there of infrastructure investors and infrastructure assets, where you know whom to partner with, where the capital supply sits in the value chain, where the productive assets sit, and how the transmission mechanism works. So that's where I'm quite grateful for our investment team that has decades of experience. Like, it's a very long-standing team that goes around and sources those deals or creates those deals where they don't exist.
Right. And I note from going through your materials, that coming back to the UK, that you have agreed a transaction, or you're going to work with Nest, which is the, you know, the pensions-based system that most of us contribute for our, you know, for our employees. Just explain a little bit about how that came about and what that will mean.
Yeah, so it's not only Nest. There are a number of other partners here in the UK, such as USS and Borders to Coast, and actually PLSA as well, so the collective vehicle of the pension funds here in the UK. We partnered with them and also with some of our Australian owners and clients. And we worked with the government here, the Department of Business and Trade in particular, to create the so-called Energy Transition Blueprint. It replicates the experience that we already have in Australia, where this Energy Transition Blueprint helps our owners, ourselves, work with the government and prioritize where the government should focus its limited resources to be able to help to green the economy, to transition it to the net zero future, but also to do it in a commercially responsible way there where they can attract private capital. So if you look at both countries, the situation is that there is private capital that wants to be invested and generate returns, and then the economy in both instances needs this capital. But the transmission mechanism between the providers of capital and the economy is not really fine-tuned. And the mechanisms in which you fine-tune it will be different from country to country. In the US, it's Inflation Reduction Act. So you have the strength of currency there, for now at least, to be able to do the stimulus of this extent. It's not possible for the country like Australia or in the UK. So what we did with the likes of Nest and USS and Border to Coast here in the UK is to essentially come together and say, so what we can do there to help and catalyze these investments into energy transition. One of the recommendations was actually already implemented by Rachel Reeves, even before the budget, where there was a suggestion on how to change the treatment of these productive assets on Treasury's balance sheet. So by recognizing them on the asset side, you're actually releasing some of the capacity of the budget there and increase the capacity for borrowing. So one of the recommendations, like the energy blueprint, was out, but because of all the work prior to that, is already recommended. And then there are a number of instances I would actually recommend to check it out. It's on our website, but just even if you Google the Energy Transition Blueprint UK, it will be out there. So what could be done by the National Wealth Fund here in the UK or by the Great British Energy to be able to help direct the private capital into the right causes is out there.
So all of the investor conversation has been about institutions. But when David Neil, your CEO, came on last year, we also touched on why the private wealth cohort has been largely absent. And I've spent my life sort of working with, you know, various families around the world. I still very rarely see it. Is it equally applicable for a large amount of family wealth to think about this?
Absolutely. And if anything, it's probably even more applicable now, because if you look at the institutional world, it's again in the research that we did recently, the private markets asset stock is around 24 trillion, which is out of the industry of 120 trillion, is already 20% is in private markets. If you look at the private wealth universe, which is like 70 plus trillion and growing really fast, the allocation to private markets is much less significant. The allocation to infrastructure is pretty much non-existent. But the interest is absolutely there because of this wonderful combination of characteristics of being both the ballast and the buoyancy of your portfolio. So we actually have quite a few conversations now with private wealth clients. And it's also interesting because if you think about the savings industry overall, actually, in Australia, where our origins are, the superannuation system really helps working people. So just thinking about our purpose and why we were created to help working people retire. Now, if you think about UK or countries such as Spain or Italy, the superannuation alternative doesn't exist. And the public pension alternative, it just allows you to cover basics. So people are forced into saving themselves. Or the gig economy, where people are not getting any ability to have institutional pensions, so they need to be thinking about it themselves. And so the constitution of the savings industry is changing. It remains to be seen how this will evolve, because that's really hard for individuals to be saving themselves. But for now, the trend is quite clear that there is a push from institutions into the individual responsibility and ensuring that people do have a variety of options, including this asset class that was to a degree created by our owners in Australia, is actually quite a motivating part of the job.
And so before we leave infrastructure, my question that I couldn't answer when I thought about it was, you've got commercial real estate sitting in that silo and you've got infrastructure. There are some characteristics that overlap. How should investors think about those two specific propositions versus each other?
Yeah, well, it genuinely depends on the investor. There is also an element that I was just discussing with someone coincidentally recently, that there is a big element of property in infrastructure, because if you think about an airport or a port, there is a big chunk there which is essentially property. It's just a different type of commercial property. But let's just step back and think about it as an institutional investor. The first question is, do you have allocation to this too? More likely than not, if you are outside Australia, then probably you have single digits, if at all, in infrastructure, and probably approaching double digits in property, right? And then if you think about property, especially the commercial end of it, there is, as I alluded to at the start, quite significant changes there. A lot of them are related to the changing preferences of society, the way we work, how we work. So office in particular is being rebalanced, but then also how the retail industry, shopping centers, warehouses, so all of this is shifting, and the valuations are shifting because obviously the interest rates increased so quickly. So there is the whole revaluation of properties coming through the market. So as an investor here in commercial real estate, you really need to be thinking, okay, so what do I do with the current portfolio? How do I reposition it? And when is the opportunity to buy or to sell? Because this asset class is in the state of shift. Infrastructure, I think at the moment, as I said, most allocators will have small allocations than justified, but B, you cannot find shifts of a similar nature where it's moving both negative and positive side. Most of the trends there are tailwinds. So as a result, when you think about the infrastructure portfolio, you are more inclined to say, okay, this is where I will grow because I can tap into both resiliency and growth. And on real estate, I really need to be much more thoughtful about what I do with my current allocation.
So we've talked about infrastructure. The other half of your business is 30 odd billion in debt investments and another 45 in equity investments. I might be out by a few
plus
billion,
minus,
but just tell us a little bit about, you know, the key mission in each of those segments and how you do it.
Yeah. So in debt, we have pretty significant debt capabilities in Australia across the range of debt instruments. And this is where we work with our owners to essentially service their needs, be it just simple fixed income portfolio or special situations in Australia. Outside Australia, we have fairly significant exposure to infrastructure debt. So just playing to our core competency there in infrastructure, and this is where we also have a lot of third-party clients investing in infrastructure. And again, just thinking, sorry, I'm talking quite a lot about the tailwinds, but I find these tailwinds and megatrends quite exciting. So I was talking about the need to build. Well, when you build infrastructure, there is so much that you take in equity, the rest of it needs to come in debt, and it's fairly attractive. Or the existing assets that would need refinancing, and again, this is a very attractive proposition. There is another element there that we were talking about, the savings industry. So quite a significant chunk of it goes into private wealth now, where the growth is being seen. But then also there is the rise of life insurers, right? Here in the UK, the buyouts of DB pensions. And for these type of asset allocators, infrastructure debt portfolios are really attractive from the regulatory perspective, the capital charges that they have, which are much lower on infrastructure debt than on other assets. So that's the proposition there. I can very much expect that it will continue to grow for the reasons that I described. Shall I talk about private equity?
Yes, talk about what you're doing in private equity.
In private equity, at the moment, we have the business in Australia as well that invests in technology and in services. So it's a very successful business in Australia. And again, at the moment, it's mostly services our shareholders, our owners, super funds in Australia. Now, what we are thinking as part of this growth strategy mandate that I joined to help build and expand is to grow this proposition and leverage these capabilities to expand into infratech space. So we were talking about this infrastructure assets that are resilient and allow institutional investors to grow and achieve returns as well. But then these assets, they need new technology, right? So just thinking about what AI can do with electricity grids or with water utilities to make sure that we utilize these resources in a much more sensible way. Or carbon capture technologies, for example. Some of it are becoming more and more mainstream, but then there are technologies out there that are more in the venture capital type of the return spectrum. And we almost like with our infrastructure portfolio, assets, capabilities, we almost like have such deep knowledge of this ecosystem and also have incumbent customers there. So if we develop sustainable aviation fuel for airports in Australia, the same technology can be used in the UK or in the US. So I'm quite excited about this part of our proposition, how we can develop the suite of infratech services for our investors, but also for the benefit of the economy.
And when you think about those investors who join with you, they can see some of the benefits of the lower fee structures that's attendant with it, but who are the ideal investors for you?
Ideal investors will have fairly long-term time horizon. So this was the DNA that our owners introduced in our creation. They set us up because the asset management industry was not offering them the alternative that would allow them to hold assets forever. And so thinking about those partners, those clients who are more likely to relate to what we do and being able to leverage it, it should be the long-term time horizon and also focus or rather relation to the fact that those themes, trends that we were describing, be it energy transition, decarbonization, or technology, AI, digitization, that these long-term trends create opportunity for long-term investments. That would be ideal partners for us.
Great.
Well, it's a good time to introduce the research that we recently did with the Financial Times. It's called Private Markets 700. We interviewed 700 institutional investors around the world and asked their views about private markets.
So, Luba, now you've had the easy questions. Now, as an expert second guest here, I can put you on the spot with some rapid-fire questions.
Yeah, I'm going to soften
you
up.
You move to a job. Sometimes people move to a senior job and they expect to be traveling less. I think you are on the road all the time. How many plane trips have you taken in the last 12 months?
I don't know. I stopped counting. In Europe, they keep asking me questions like, did you count the number of days you spent here?
Of course.
But one factoid is that I actually count the number of countries that I have visited. And it was actually quite sad that I was stopped on my way to 100 by the pandemic. So I was at 98 in 2019, but I am way above 100 right now. So after 100, I stopped counting countries.
So you speak at and you attend all sorts of conferences around the world. Which one stands out?
I do like Fiduciary Investor Symposium. So that's the one that I did in California with the state controller of California, Malia Cohen. So that was really a great opportunity to talk about energy transition in California, an amazing conference. And I think it is next week is Baku COP, and then the week after next is Oxford Financial Investor Symposium. Also, earlier this week, I was in The Hague at the Pensions and Investor Pension World Summit. I think this is a really good gathering as well, because most of the investors in the room are pension funds.
Lots of our guests have success stories, but generally there will have been pockets of setbacks. And I wonder what advice you would give in terms of resilience when you've met an obstacle or a setback, how you have dealt with it and what you advise people who have that ahead.
Yeah, well, it's quite obvious. Don't give up. But then at the same time, when I was younger, I genuinely was not giving up 100%. And then over time, I just figured out that sometimes if you are trying to push through the wall and it's not yielding, then you can go around the wall. So not giving up, but sometimes pivoting to ensure that you get to your objective faster.
And you are playing a pivotal role in helping IFM grow its global footprint. That creates cultural challenges as you assimilate different people, etc. What do you think's top of your list when you think about building the right culture?
It's actually having empathy. And I think back to your question about traveling, just going around the world, listening to people and understanding how they think differently, how the backgrounds, the history will be different in different countries. I do think that I have a somewhat unfair privilege that I lived in so many countries and indeed in different socioeconomic systems. If I were to give an advice on how to increase this cultural awareness, actually travel, going and spending time with people and listening more than talking actually helps create this right culture across multiple cultures.
We asked a few years ago Dave Yarrow, who's become the world's most successful photographer, having been a hedge fund manager, where would be the one place if he could only have one holiday? And he said he'd go back to Montana. If you could have just one holiday, where would you go?
Yeah, I would go back to Bhutan. I really loved this holiday there. And there is a reason why it is considered to be the happiest country in the world. It's a beautiful place.
Well, as we speak, my wife is in Mustang, not so far away, tracking.
Yes, it is. Wonderful.
And I'm here in London working. And
sorry. My fault, right?
Excuse you. And my last question is unclimbed peaks. What is on the Luba Nicolina map that is yet to be conquered?
Unclimbed peaks, physical or metaphorical?
Metaphorical.
Metaphorical. I did used to climb when I was younger. I don't remember if I mentioned it in the first episode. So 7,000 meters Aconcagua in South America was the highest that I've been. So this was the physical peak and I decided I will stop. Everest was in my mind at some point, but I think no longer too old for that. And metaphorical peaks is genuinely to help IFM to exercise the influence that it has the potential to for the benefit of people who trust us with their savings, the working people of this world.
So that's a great place to stop. I like to sum up. I've written down four things. One is that your sense is that for global allocators, we're at a tipping point, which has some echoes of the excitement that built around private equity over 20 years ago. Number two is that when you look at Australia and Canada with allocations, institutional allocations that, you know, might be between 10 and 20%, that is not yet mirrored in the rest of the world, but signs are that it will. You have this report out we will feature, which is the private markets, you know, 700, and you weren't entirely happy with the term ballast in the boat. So maybe we should describe infrastructure as brilliant, buoyant ballast.
Agreed. I'm all for it.
So, Luba, maybe 2 years' time we'll have you back. And it's been great to see you again today. Thank
you. It's a pleasure, Simon. Thank you.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.